Chapter 4. Norway. The bright April weather had collapsed in a heap before St. Ives and his man Hasbro had chuffed into Dover, and the North Sea was a tumult of wind-tossed waves and driving rain. St. Ives huddled now aboard the Ostend ferry, out of the rain beneath an overhanging deck ledge, and wrapped in an oilcloth, legs spread to counter the heaving swell. His pipe burned like a chimney. Occasional drops, swirling in on the wind, drove into his face, and the orange coal in the pipe bowl hissed and sputtered. He peered out at the rolling black of the heavens, equally dark thoughts drawing his eyes into a squint and making him oblivious to the cold and wet. Had this sudden turn of Arctic weather anything to do with the experimentation of the Royal Academy? Had they effected the reversal of the poles prematurely and driven the weather suddenly mad? Had Kraken failed? He watched the gray swell loom overhead, threatening to slam him into paste, and then sink suddenly into nothing as if having changed its mind, only to tower up once again overhead, sheets of flying foam torn from its crest and rendering it into vapor. His plans seemed to be going fast aglay. The Zeppelin he'd counted upon for transport had been inoperable, or so he'd been told. The fate of the Earth itself hung in the balance, and the filthy Zeppelin was inoperable? They'd all be inoperable by the end of the week. Jack Owlsby had stayed on in Ramsgate, where a crew of nitwits fiddled with the craft, and so yet another variable, as the mathematician would say, had been cast into the muddled stew. Could the Zeppelin be made operable in time? Would Jack, along with the flea-brained pilot, find them out in the cold wastes of Arctic Norway? It didn't bear thinking about. One thing at a time, St. Ives reminded himself. They'd left Jack with a handshake and a compass and had raced south, intending to follow Norbando overland, as it were, trusting to Jack to take care of himself. But where was Ignacio Norbando? He'd set sail from Dover with Hargreaves hours earlier, there could be no doubt about that. But the ticket agent could find no record of his having boarded the Dover-Ostend ferry. St. Ives had described him vividly. The hump, the tangle of oily hair, the cloak. No one could remember having seen him board. Had he somehow discovered that agents were at work to foil his efforts? Did he suspect that Beezer had been abducted and that his mail had been interfered with? It was conceivable, just barely, that St. Ives had made a monumental error, or that Norbando had tricked a lot of them, had been one up on them all along. He might at that moment be bound, say, for Reykjavik, intent on working his deviltry on the volcanic wastes of the interior of Iceland. The world was vast, full of trackless wilderness. Here was St. Ives, bobbing on the sea like a tin soldier aboard a cork boat, vainly supposing from his vantage point on the heaving deck that he could somehow anticipate the movements of a madman. Two madmen. If he and Hasbro arrived in Ostend and there was no word of Norbando, what then? If no porter or ticket-taker, no vagabond or bun-seller, no cleaning woman or constable had seen the hunchback, what would they do? Go on, St. Ives decided. But in Ostend, the rain let up and the wind fell off, and the solid ground beneath his feet lent a steadiness of purpose to St. Ives once again and settled his topsy-turvy stomach. In the cold station, a woman stirred a cauldron of mussels in a wall niche, dumping in handfuls of shallots and lumps of butter. Aromatic steam swirled out of the iron pot in such a way as to make St. Ives lightheaded. Mussels and beer, he said to Hasbro, would revive a body. That they would, sir, and a loaf of bread, I might add, to provide bulk. A sound suggestion, said St. Ives, striding toward the woman and removing his hat. She dumped open mussels, black and dripping, into a roughly woven basket lined with newspaper, heaping up the shells until they threatened to cascade to the floor. She winked at St. Ives, fished an enormous mussel from the pot, slid her thumbs into the hiatus of the open shell, and in a single swift movement pulled the mollusk open, shoved one of her thumbs under the orange flesh, and flipped the morsel into her open mouth. "Some don't chew them," she said, speaking English, "but I do. What's the use of eating at all if you don't chew them? Might as well swallow a toad. Do you know what I mean?" "Indubitably," said St. Ives. "It's the same way with oysters. I never could simply stand to allow the creatures to slide down my throat. I fly in the face of custom there." "Ay," she said, "can you imagine a man's stomach full of beasts such as these, whole, mind you, and sloshing like smelts in a bucket?" She canted her head at St. Ives as if expecting an answer. then dipped again into the cauldron and tossed another mussel down, grimacing almost immediately and rooting around in her half-filled mouth with a finger. "Mussel pearl," she said, holding it up between a thumb and forefinger, a tiny opalescent sphere twice the size of a pinhead. She slid open a little drawer in the cart on which sat a cauldron of mussels and dropped the pearl in among what must have been thousands of the tiny orbs, picking at her back teeth thereafter with a bent fingernail. "Can't stand debris," she said, grimacing. The entire display rather took the edge off St. Ives' appetite, and the heap of mussels in the basket, reclining beneath the coat of congealing butter and bits of garlic and shallot, began to remind him of certain unfortunate suppers he'd consumed at the Baywater Club. He grinned weakly at the woman and looked around at the hurrying crowds, wondering if he and Hasbro hadn't ought to join them. "Man in here this afternoon ate one shell and all," she said, shaking her head. "Imagine the debris. Must have given his throat bones some trouble, I dare say." "Shell and all?" asked St. Ives. "That's the exact case. Crunched away at the thing like it was a marzipan crust, didn't he? Then he took another, chewed it up about halfway, saw what he was about, and spit the filthy thing against the wall there. You can see bits of it still, can't you? Despite the birds swarming round. There's the smear of it against the paint. Do you see it there? Bit of brown paste is all that amounts to now." I stared at the woman. "Big man?" "Who?" "The fellow who ate the shells. Big, was he? With a beard? Seemed ready to fly into a rage?" "That's your man, gents. Cursed vilely, he did. But it weren't at the shells. It was at the poor birds, wasn't it? And when they come round to eat up what your man spit off the wall, you can see it there, can't you? I never. Was he in the company of a hunchback?" "Aye," said the woman, giving her pot a perfunctory stirring. "Greasy little man with a grin. Seemed to think the world is a lark. But it ain't no lark, gentlemen. Here you been wasting my time this quarter hour, and not another living soul has bought a shell. You frightened the lot of them off, is what I think, and you haven't paid me a penny." She glowered at St. Ives and glowered at Hasbro. "What time this afternoon?" asked St. Ives. 3 hours past, say, or four? Might have been five. Or less." "Thank you," said St. Ives, reaching into his pocket for a handful of coin. He dumped a half-crown into her outstretched hand and left her blinking, he and Hasbro racing through the terminal toward the distant exit, each of them clutching a Gladstone bag in one hand and a basket of mussels in the other. The streets were wet outside, but the clouds were broken overhead and were taking flight in the gray dusk, and the wind had simmered down to a sort of billowy breeze. A bent man shambled past in trousers meant for a behemoth, clutching at the buttonless coat. St. Ives thrust his basket of mussels at the man, meaning to do him a good turn, but his gesture was mistaken, for the man peered at them with a look of mingled surprise and loathing in his eyes, fetching the basket a swipe with his hand and set the entire affair into the gutter. St. Ives strode on without a word, marveling at how little space existed at times between madness and the best of intentions. In a half hour, they were aboard a train once more in a sleeping car bound for Amsterdam, Hamburg, and finally, Horing, where the Denmark ferry they'd once again set sail across the North Sea up the Oslo Ford into Norway. St. Ives was determined to remain awake, to have a look at the comet when it arced in over the horizon sometime after midnight. But the sleepless night he'd spent in the observatory and the long hours of travel since had worn him thin, and after a tolerable meal in the dining car, and what might likely turn out to be on the morrow a regrettable lot of brandy, he dropped away at once into a deep sleep. The comet rose in the sky and fell again without him, slanting past the captive earth. In Oslo, Hargreaves had beaten a man half senseless with the man's own cane. In Trondheim, 2 hours before the arrival of St. Ives and Hasbro on the express, he'd run mad and threatened to explode a greengrocer's cart, kicking the spokes out of one of the wheels before Narbando had hauled him away and explained to the authorities that his companion was a lunatic bound for a sanatorium in Natvik. St. Ives itched to be after them, but here he sat, becalmed in a small brick railway station. The doctor wouldn't know that he was so closely pursued. He'd stop in a village for a meal, and St. Ives and Hasbro would be upon him as he shoved down a forkful of codfish. St. Ives stared impatiently out the window at the nearly empty station. A delay of a minute seemed an eternity, and each sighing release of steam from the waiting train carried upon it the suggestion of a final, fateful explosion, which Dr. Narbando, perhaps having finished his codfish quite happily by now, might at this very moment be affecting. Hasbro, St. Ives could see, was equally uneasy at their motionless state, for he sat hunched forward on his seat as if trying to compel the train into flight. Finally, amid tooting and whooshing and three false starts, they were away again. St. Ives prayed that the engineer had understood his translated request that they make an unscheduled stop on the deserted tundra adjacent to Mount Harstad. Surely he would. He'd accepted the little bag of assorted coffee tablets readily enough. What could he have understood them to be except a bribe? Darkness had long since fallen, and with it had fled the last of the scattered rain showers. Ragged clouds, pursued by arctic wind, capered across the sky, and the stars shone thick and bright between. The train developed steam after chuffing along lazily up a steepening grade, and within a score of minutes was hurtling through the mountainous countryside. St. Ives was gripped once more with the excitement and peril of the chase. He removed his pocket watch at intervals, putting it back without so much as glancing at it, loosening his collar, and peering out across the rocky landscape at the distant swerve of track ahead, when the train lurched into a curve, as if the engine they pursued might be visible a half-mile further on. The slow, labored climb of steep hills was almost instantly maddening and filled him again with the fear that their efforts would prove futile, that from the vantage point of the next peak they'd witness the detonation of half of Scandinavia, crumbling mountainsides, hurtling rocks. They thundered through shrieking tunnels, the starry sky going momentarily black, then reappearing in an instant only to be dashed again into darkness. And when the train burst each time into the cold Norwegian night, both St. Ives and Hasbro were pressed against the windows peering skyward, relieved to see the last scattered clouds fleeing before the wind. Then, all at once, as if they'd been waved into existence by a magic wand, the lights of the Aurora Borealis swept across the sky in lacy showers of green and red and blue, like a semi-transparent Christmas tapestry hung among the wash of the stars. "Yes!" cried St. Ives, leaping to his feet and nearly pitching into the aisle as they rushed howling into another tunnel. "He's done it! Kraken has done it!" "Indeed, sir?" "Absolutely," said St. Ives animatedly, "without the shadow of a doubt. The northern lights, my good fellow, are a consequence of the Earth's electromagnetic field. It's a simple matter. No field, no lights. Had Lord Kelvin's machine done the job, the display you see before us would have been postponed for heavens knows how many woeful years. But here it is, isn't it? Good old Bill." And on this last cheerful note, they emerged once again into the aurora-lit night, hurtling along beside a broad cataract that tumbled down through boulder-strewn gorge. Another hour's worth of tunnels, however, began to make it seem finally as if there were no end to their journey. As if, perhaps, their train labored round and round a clever circular track that they had been monumentally hoaxed one last fatal time by Dr. Ignacio Narbando. And then, in an effort of steam, they crested one last steep summit. Away to the west, far below them, moonlight shimmered on the rippled surface of a fjord stretching out to the distant Norwegian sea. Tumbling down out of the rocky precipices to their right rushed the wild river they'd followed for what seemed like an age, the torrent wrapping round the edge of Mount Kjarstad and disappearing into the shadow where it cascaded, finally, into the vast emptiness of an abyss. A trestled bridge spanned the cataract and gave out into a tundra-covered plain scattered with the angular moon shadows of tilted stones. Between two such shadows lay a strange and alien object. A sizable steamer trunk, its lid thrown back, its contents removed. Beyond, 100 yards distant, lay another, yanked over onto its side. The train raced past both before howling to a steam-shrieking stop. St. Ives and Hasbro pitched their bags out onto the icy plain and leaped out after them, the train almost immediately setting out north towards Hammerfest, leaving the world and the two men to their collective fate. St. Ives hurried across the plain towards the slope of Mount Hjarstad. A footpath wound upward along the edge of the precipice through which the river thundered and roiled. "I'm afraid we've rather announced our arrival through a megaphone," shouted St. Ives over his shoulder. "Let us hope," he huffed, "that the doctor is too anxious to culminate his exertions to pay us any real heed." "Perhaps the roar of the falls," shouted Hasbro at St. Ives' back. But the rest of his words were lost in the watery tumult as the two men leaped up the steepening hill. St. Ives patted his coat, feeling beneath it the hard foreign bulk of his revolver. With the exception of certain loathsome bugs, he had an aversion to the killing of anything at all, and he wondered, as he edged along the trail, peering past tumbled rock, listening to the unfathomable roar of the maelstrom below, whether he could deliberately shoot either of the madmen that labored above them, even if the consequence was the delivery of humankind out of their wretched clutches. There was a shout behind him. A crack like a pistol shot followed, and St. Ives threw himself onto his face, rolling against the carriage-sized boulder. A hail of stones showered roundabout, and an enormous circular rock, big as a cartwheel, bounded over his head, soaring away into the misty depths of the abyss. Above, leaping from perch to rocky perch, was a man with wild hair and beard. Hargreaves. There could be little doubt. St. Ives rolled to his knees, drew his revolver, steadied his forearm along the top of the rock, and fired twice at the retreating figure. His bullets pinged off rocks 20 feet short of their mark, but the effect on the anarchist was startling. It was as if he'd been turned suddenly into a mountain sheep. Again, St. Ives sat out up the footpath, but Hasbro, following Hargreaves's lead, pursued a course across the granite hillside, gesturing to St. Ives as he disappeared into shadow. St. Ives pressed against the stony path of the wall, crept along carefully, grimly imagining himself following the course of the plummeting stone, and wondering at the fate of the redoubtable Hasbro. Ice crunched underfoot, and the hillside opened up briefly on his right to reveal a steep depression in the rock, a sort of conical hole at the bottom of which lay a black, silent tarn. The water brimmed with reflected stars washed out with blue-red light from the aurora. Abruptly, he rounded a sharp bend, and there above him, perched on the rim of the smoking crater and hauling on the coils of a mechanical bladder, was the venomous Hargreaves, the steamy reek of boiling mud swirling about his head and shoulders. Ignacio Narbondo capered beside him, dancing from one foot to the other like a man treading on hot pavement. They were too distant to shoot at. Anything further off than 40 feet confounded St. Ives' aim. Where was Hasbro? How in the world were either of them to interfere with the rapidly culminating shenanigan above them without racing into the muzzle of a gun? St. Ives was struck with the awful loneliness of the cold night, of the Arctic wind slanting across the hillsides, of the black and gray landscape and the unearthly beauty of the northern lights. He slid 2 bullets into the empty chambers of his revolver and stepped forward, intent upon simply brassing it out, come what may. The anarchist grappled now with a Gladstone bag. His curses reached St. Ives on the wind. Narbondo raged beside him, looking hastily back and forth between the approaching St. Ives and his fumbling companion. St. Ives smiled grimly and pressed on, pistol aimed, shouting into the wind for Narbondo to give off. But the doctor was oblivious to exhortations. He peered suddenly skyward, his forearm thrown across his brow as if to shade his eyes from moonlight. St. Ives followed Narbondo's gaze, vaguely conscious of a low hum droning, it seemed, in the back of his ears. The crescent moon bobbed along above the aurora, and below it, dropping into the pale blue wash of color, was the dark, ovoid silhouette of a descending zeppelin. "Hooray!" cried St. Ives, forgetting himself momentarily and understanding Narbondo's anxiety. Emboldened, he took a determined step forward, hearing the crack of Hargreaves' pistol almost at the same time that the bullet struck him in the shoulder. He cried out and dropped to his knees, his revolver spinning away into the void. A shriek followed, and St. Ives looked up to see Hargreaves, pistol smoking in one hand and Gladstone bag gripped in the other, lurch round, teeter for a moment on the edge of the crater, and topple off, disappearing utterly into the mouth of the volcano. Narbondo making one futile grab at the bag clutched in Hargreaves' disappearing hand. A prolonged but diminishing shriek ended moments later, followed by a thunderous explosion, the volatile contents of the bag having been detonated by the fires of Mount Hjärstad. St. Ives clutched his shoulder as Hasbro stepped out of the shadows above, leveling his pistol at the furious Narbondo in a manner that implied he'd brook no nonsense, that Narbondo was an ace away from following Hargreaves into the pit. Narbondo shrugged and seemed to slump, half raising his hands in resignation. Then, without so much as a backward glance, he bolted down the footpath toward St. Ives, gathering momentum, running headlong at the surprised scientist. Hasbro aimed the pistol, but a shot was impossible. St. Ives would be imperiled. Norbondo leaped along in great springing strides, his face contorted now with fear and wonderment. St. Ives threw himself sideways, and Norbondo whirled past in uncontrolled, headlong flight. It seemed certain that at the bend in the footpath he'd find himself plummeting into the abyss, but such was not to be. He tripped, tumbled, bounced shrieking off a rock, and caromed back into the hillside, head over heels, sliding across the steep, slippery slope into the black water of the tarn. The reflection of the moon and stars on the surface disintegrated, bits and pieces dancing wildly, but by the time Hasbro, hat in hand, had made his way down to where his master stood staring into the depths of the pool, the surface was placid once again. "He's gone," said St. Ives simply. "Will he float surfaceward, sir?" "Not necessarily," replied the scientist. "I rather believe that the fall knocked the wind from him. He'll stay down until he bloats with gases, until he begins to rot. And the water, I fear, is so cold as to slow the process substantially, perhaps indefinitely. We could wait a bit just to be certain, but I very much fear that waiting would be injudicious." And with that, St. Ives nodded at the horizon where glowed a great arc of white fire. As the two men watched, the flaming orb of the comet crept skyward, enormous now, as if it were soaring in to swallow the puny earth at a gulp. Hasbro nodded quietly. "Shall we fetch our equipment, sir?" "We'll want the lot of it," said St. Ives, "and to all appearances, we'll want it quickly. We've a long and wearisome journey yet before us." He sighed deeply. His shoulder began suddenly to ache. He turned one last time towards the tarn which had stolen from him the satisfaction of confronting the defeated Ignacio Norbondo. "I very much suspect," he said in a low and measured tone, "that our villain has found an icy and not undeserved grave, no less fitting than that of his accomplice. It almost seemed choreographed, doesn't it, by some higher authority?" Hasbro stood for a moment as if in silent contemplation, then replaced his hat and set off up the path, leaving St. Ives to welcome Jack Owlsby, whose hurried footfall scuffled up the trail behind them.